Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, it's Mike Calvin here. I've just heard about Ronald Koeman's sacking. It was announced about an hour or so after we recorded this episode. No real surprise, Everton have had little return on their £144 million summer investment. Too many similar players, not enough quality to replace Romelu Lukaku. Koeman's man management has been poor. He's been tactically exposed. Confidence is shattered. Everton are in the bottom three. Put simply, that's not good enough. On with the show. Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and David Priest, the former Aberdeen and Sunderland goalkeeper. Now, we all know that football management is a blood sport. Apparently, Slaven Bilic has two games to save his job at West Ham. Ronald McDonald would be a more popular Everton manager than Ronald Koeman. Leicester are looking for a new manager, while Mark Hughes is being booed at Stoke. The cull's coming, isn't it?
It's that time of year, isn't it? I mean, you always look at the transfer window as being the kind of main driver of these things, and we're now, what, sort of 7 or 8 weeks away from it. It's a time that if a club's going to try and invest and then change their fortune in the second half of the season, you really need to be looking at signings now. And I think that focuses clubs' minds about who they want in charge to try and keep them up or not. And that's what we're seeing in the Premier League at the moment. I think there will be a couple of departures over the next few weeks. I mean, Koeman and Mark Hughes, I think, are probably the most under threat, and you might actually say with good reason, because they've both been backed very substantially by their clubs and probably have squads that they can't excuse themselves out of and say anybody else put these squads together. It's their work.
Well, let's look at Everton, David. You know, that squad, as much has been spent on that squad has been spent on Bayern Munich squad. So you've got to point the finger at the recruitment side of things, but the manager always will take the can.
Yeah, you're right, but it's amazing what people could see in the summer is bearing fruit now. The people thought that, yes, there was some good signs in there, they were getting the business done early, you know, there's lots of pats on the back, but there was lots of question marks over the lack of pace and buying similar sort of players and a lot of them untried. And the amount of players that they signed as well, you know, it's not going to happen overnight. They're not going to gel straight away. But it just doesn't seem to be getting any better for them at all. I think that Ronald, if he's given the time, he can turn it around. The players are good enough, but I don't know.
They were all over the place, weren't they, on Sunday?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think about clubs and their identities, and Everton have always been, you know, principally, they call themselves a people's club. They've been a hard-working, passionate, fierce club, particularly at home, and that seems to have disappeared from the football. You know, to see supporters leaving 10 minutes from time, not even having the passion to stay and boo the manager, I mean, that's really unlike Everton. And they had that lack of edge to them. They had a lack of basic organisation. I read somewhere that Koeman, he substituted Ashley Williams at half-time. That's 9 games out of 17 this season where he's made a half-time change, which is an admission he's got it wrong. They seem to be drifting because nobody knows even now what he really thinks his best first team is, why the three number 10s that we've talked about were signed, what he wants to do up front, but we're still not really sure. And then there's a mix of some really good young players coming through, but all these kind of experience signings that he's made. So it's another thing where you're not really sure what kind of identity of a team that he's trying to put together. And all those things make it a worrying situation for Everton.
Mm. I mean, people keep going about the money that they spent and the fact that if people have successes here, well, they've got money to spend, but it's an example of that if you don't spend it properly, then it doesn't matter how much you've got to spend. Yeah. And that's the problem that brings he's got a great squad now together, and he's got a big squad. It's just picking the right players. Mm.
What, you've been in dressing rooms. What is the atmosphere like when things are turning sour? Do people start getting defensive and thinking about themselves?
There is that, and then there's a lot of finger-pointing as well. I think that, you know, you look at someone like Ashley Williams, I think you see the frustration getting to him. Mm. I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, what happened with the fan holding the kid.
That was unreal, by the way.
It was, but for me, I don't know, it's just the way I look at it, but the fact that he's got a lifetime ban from the stadium. Now, and Ashley Williams is the one who lost total control and incited the whole incident, gets away with a yellow card. I don't know anything will happen afterwards. But the frustration's there, and it's seeping into the players now, and I think it's...
Is that a player who sees the end of his career coming at him fast?
Mm. No, I think it's just a player who's in trouble with his form and... The frustrations are coming out in different ways, and you'd see that, not just in the way that he's playing, but his whole demeanour. And I think it's symptomatic of what's happening in Everton.
I mean, David will know better than me, but when any club makes a whole raft of signings at one time, when you look at the numbers, you know, 7 or 8 coming into a squad, I think that always changes the dynamic, doesn't it? And when there are new players coming into a kind of troubled situation, that it's got a knock-on effect. It's harder for them to find their feet, but also, they're not going to kind of rally around the cause in the same way that, you know, more established players are going to, because they don't know what the cause is. Mm. So there's been a number of these things. Brendan Rodgers making 7 or 8 signings, getting sacked quite quickly afterwards. I think was it Harry Redknapp that did it at Spurs?
You know, he's done it everywhere, hasn't he?
Yeah. Did it at Derby, did it at Birmingham. But whenever there's a big clutch of signings, you've got to be careful about the dressing room dynamic, because Leicester last year, you can lose very quickly what you had.
Because that's the point you made right at the start. You know, what does a club represent? What is its identity? You've got the same issue at Leicester, haven't you?
Absolutely. And I'm scratching my head now about what kind of club the owners there think Leicester are going to be. I mean, they had the template laid down by Nigel Pearson and Steve Walsh, which Ranieri built on, and the whole thing was this sort of underdog club that was overachieving. To now sort of, you know, get rid of Shakespeare quite early in the season, after doing pretty well last season anyway, and look at people like Carlo Ancelotti and, you know, maybe Mancini. I just don't quite see the fit there, and I can't see the logic in it. Surely they know what got them the success in the first place. Mm. And surely they can also look at that group of players and think, well, the best players we've got are still the best players we had from 2015-16. We know what works for them. But, you know, maybe success means that they can't quite see things like that anymore.
Mm. It also begs the question, you know, if we're talking about managers leaving, you know, obviously Shakespeare's gone, what about the quality of the managers who are available? So let's take Everton as an example. David Moyes has been spoken about, which I'm sure John can talk to us about in a minute. But, you know, David Wagner's already been spoken of. Now, he's going to stay, he says, at Huddersfield for the rest of the season. It's all very well sacking someone, but you've got to get someone else in. Who are the natural candidates for a Leicester or for an Everton or for a West Ham?
I think we look at Leicester. If they want to go down the same route that's got them success, like Jonathan says, you know. I mean, do you go for someone like Sam Allardyce? Mm-hmm. Somebody who's in that mould of the team that they'd already built and they got the success on. I'm not sure about that. It depends, like Jonathan was saying, about where they want to go, where they see themselves. Do they still see themselves as that club that they've got the success from being hard work and playing a certain way? Or do they want to change? And we can see from Crystal Palace this year that if they're going to do that, they've got to give the next manager a bit more time to work with.
Mm. What about David Moyes? I know you know him pretty well.
Well, there'd be a lot of logic in him going back to Everton from the point of view he knows how it works. He kind of built the modern Everton to a large extent. He's still very closely you know, linked to Everton. He knows people there, follows them very closely. And I think he would do a good job. But my worry for him would be how the fans would receive it, and maybe even how the media would receive it, because we all like novelty in football, and I think the modern fan particularly likes novelty. And I feel there would be a sort of negativity against that appointment from the start, which, given the experiences he had at Sunderland and Sociedad, which ended up being very negative, I don't think that'd be a very good way for him to start the job. I think if we could cut through all of that, look at it logically, it would be a good appointment. But we, the media and fans, do influence the conditions in which people work.
I think with Everton, if they appointed David Moyes, I'd always say that as a short-term answer, really.
Do you think?
Until they knew exactly where they wanted to go. And because they've got the finances now. They've got the leeway to have a vision and to be able to build something really solid. So they need to make sure that they get the next appointment, or the you know, if it's Moyes, it's going to be a short-term appointment. The next appointment, make sure that it's long-term and not just flavour of the month, like David Wagner.
Mm. Yeah, because the nature of management has changed since Moyes went into Everton.
Yeah.
Was, you know, he came in as that sort of classic guy who'd learned his trade in his lower divisions and then got his chance. A club with Everton's pretensions will want showbiz.
I know that's exactly right. And they'll also want the manager to be a bit of a star. And I think that's been a trend, maybe started back in when Mourinho arrived, and he gave us almost this kind of film star manager idea, and that is against the traditional British manager, I feel. I mean, I think there's three outstanding candidates at the moment. It's whether you can get them from clubs, but I mean, Marco Silva obviously has got something special, and the way Sean Dyche has built Burnley, he may not play sexy continental football, but the football's better than people think, and if you're looking at someone to build an entire club and focus it. And I do think David Wagner has got an outstanding CV. I know there's a flavour of the month element to it, but it's pretty outstanding what he's done at Huddersfield. It's whether you could attract them at this point of the season. And actually, you know, things are going pretty well for all of them at their current clubs. They might look at an Everton or a Leicester and just think, you know what, I might only get 6 months there, whereas I've got clubs, they've all got clubs where they could stay for the long term. Well, maybe it's rubbish because Watford will sack anyone tomorrow, but the other two have certainly got clubs.
Speaking to people around that club, you know, there is a sense that, you know, that's a club has been defined in another generation by, say, a Graham Taylor, where he actually reshaped the club. I get the sense that they're going to try and give Marco Silva that type of chance to make an impact. I've got so many people telling me, you know, this is a mini Mourinho we've got here.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to quite a lot of Hull players last season, and they were telling me about his methods and how sort of precise he was with even going through training sessions. The training sessions would be videoed, and then they'd go and watch the videos, and he'd even point out if somebody was a yard out of place. He knew exactly, he wanted the players to know exactly where they should be stood on the pitch, wherever the ball was, where they had the ball, and whether they didn't have the ball. So it just all. It's everything that football's about at the moment. Football's moved on so much in the last 6 or 7 years. Mm. And we, you know, we're talking about David Moyes. That's why people like him have seemed to have been left behind, because it has moved on, and there's a way of doing things now which is so precise and so intricate, and there's so much work goes into it. The people like Silva, that's why he's become a success. And I think it'd be for some like Everton, it'd be a great, great fit.
It was interesting. I spoke to a former Premier League manager last week who's unemployed, you know, and so he's doing the rounds. And he basically said the one thing that he's learned in the time that he's been out is that the way the foreign coaches prepare themselves for interviews. He said they go in there, it's all singing, all dancing. He knows the name of the left back's cat. You know, it's brilliant preparation. Yeah. That's what the traditional English manager or British manager is up against.
Yeah, you're talking about job interviews, Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. Again, that's a Mourinho thing. He famously came with his 150-page dossier for
Brendan Rodgers.
People say that he nicked Mourinho's dossier and that Mourinho nicked Van Gaal's dossier, but that's another matter. But that is the kind of level of that's the brand of the foreign manager now, and that also tells you that these guys are looking at the Premier League from afar and thinking, we really want to work there.
Like Thomas Tuchel is one who obviously comes to mind.
Well, he'll probably turn up with perfect English and he'll tell you that he's, you know, we'll find out that he's spent 6 months in Bath or something studying English culture. But that's what these guys do now. Think of Guardiola going away and, you know, spending a year living, trying to learn English in preparation for a job. I think he always knew he was going to come and do one day.
But ultimately, David, it's a mad job, isn't it? They're judged by people who really aren't qualified to make those sort of judgments.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, but I mean, it's... That's the chance you take. You know, when you're going into the job, you know that's what's going to happen to you. And you can understand why the likes of Michael Appleton, you know, he's asked about the Leicester job yesterday. You can see why. And truthfully, he'll answer it saying that I'd rather stay in the job that I'm in at the moment.
I thought that was a smart answer, that.
Yeah, exactly, because it's non-committal. Of course, I think, you know, whether privately or not, he would want the job, and I'm sure he would. If he was given it, he'd take it tomorrow. But... Sometimes you're better off staying at that level and giving yourself more security because obviously there is none at that level.
I was at Stoke on Saturday and, you know, for a team that spent about £100 million, they went back to the plan Z option of just lumping it to Peter Crouch in the second half. A lot of unhappiness about Mark Hughes. Now, I think he's done a fantastic job there when you think about it. Ninth three seasons on the row, I think it was 13th last season. OK, they're in a bad run at the moment. Is that enough?
Well, this goes back to the whole... we've talked about that in this podcast before, but the kind of mid-ranking club and the kind of angst of the mid-ranking club's supporter. You know, what do they actually want? West Brom managers find it difficult, for example, because finishing 10th has become boring to the fans. And I think that's the case with Stoke. The problem that Mark Hughes has got is that every one of the last three or four seasons has followed the same pattern, which is summer investment, things are going to be better, we're going to progress, start the season badly, pulls it round, which he probably will or would if he stays for the season. But at some point, fans get bored, they want something different, they might look at Leicester, they might look at the excitement that Silva's generating at Watford and feel envious, for example. I mean, specifically on Hughes, I don't think he's invested very well this summer. And I don't think he invested very well last summer. And as you say, it is a worry when the best players there are still the players that were there maybe from the Pulis era, you know, Shawcross and Couch, you know, the guys that you can rely on. So that's a worry for him.
It's the curse of Kirbishley, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's when it all started for me in the Premier League, you know, when they have the relative success, but fans are always going to want more once they get to that level and they sort of the club plateaus.
It's an emotional business, but let's talk about an emotional club, Liverpool. At what stage do we turn around to Jurgen Klopp and say, some of this is down to you, mate?
Yeah, I know he seemed to get a little bit upset yesterday when he was questioned about the defensive performances and says, you know, that's not the...
Pretty justifiable question.
Yeah, of course it was. And you think from somebody who's a centre-half himself, you know, he kind of sarcastically said, yeah, I know how to set up defence, and he should do. But the fact of the matter is that they're letting him down consistently. Now, even yesterday, you know, you look at the... You can see it's, you know, point the finger at the end, Lovren. And make him a scapegoat if you want, but it's a collective calamity. You know, even someone like Joe Gomez, he's a centre-half playing right-back. Now, to me, you can see that. Yeah. That's the second time yesterday that he's been caught a little bit too far behind his centre-halves, playing everyone on side. Even though it's minimal, it still makes all the difference in costing them a goal. And the fact that he's a centre-half, normally with full-backs, they're a little bit more advanced than the centre-halves, so it allows Lovren to play offside, which he tried to do. Now, if you're behind your centre-half, you know, Lovren's trying to play offside for the first goal, and it obviously hasn't worked, but it's the collective. Now, once people start making bad decisions like that and they're out of sync with each other, then it affects the goalkeeper as well. And then he's obviously making bad decisions at the same time. So it's all linked.
Is Mignolet good enough for Liverpool?
Yeah, it's a good question. For them to go where they want to go and get back to the top, no. It's as simple as that. You don't make that many mistakes and win things, in all honesty. And I think that as much as Klopp says, it's, you know, it's individual mistakes and it's nothing that he can work on. Surely there must be time spent on repetition, so all the players know exactly what they're doing with each other.
Need to get the George Graham rope out, don't they? between the back four.
They need a number of things. Yeah, they need to. They patently need to work on defending, and that might not necessarily even mean the tactical side of things, the drilling side of things. Just the mindset. I think that's one of the aspects of Liverpool that has troubled me for not just in Klopp's era, but in Rodgers' era as well. That
there's some parallels, aren't there, between the two?
Coaches that fall in love with the attacking side of the game, the passion side of the game, the entertainment side of the game, giving thrills to everybody. But that's fine. But regardless of individuals, you don't see any of the defenders really committing to the job and enjoying defending in the way that, you know, the Jamie Carragher's used to do. And I think Mignolet is probably substandard, as David said, for, you know, a top four club. He's not a bad goalkeeper per se, but he's not a top four goalkeeper. But you could say that of any of those defensive players, all of the fullbacks, you know, all of the centre halves. I don't think they would be signed up by the Liverpool's rivals, any of them, if they're placed on the open transfer market. And that's a really bad comment. Mm.
As a goalkeeper, David, playing behind a defence which is making consistent repetition of, you know, individual errors, does it get into your head in the end?
Well, as you said, it affects your decision making, and it affects the positions you take up as well. I think even was it the first goal when Mignolet came?
It comes out, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the fact that it's not a strong line that's held. You know, people try to play offside in very tight positions it's not like there's a great deal of pressure on the ball. That makes a difference as well. And I think
so is that him trying to be assertive because nobody else is doing it? Is he trying to take charge of the situation by rushing out there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we watched it last week with Peter Schmeichel talking about taking a high line and being more proactive. But sometimes, I mean, in that case, I think Matip was getting across. He covered the run. He shouldn't have been out there at all. There was no chance of him getting to the ball first. He's putting himself in danger, putting his teammates in danger. And like I said, it affects everybody. So you can't point your finger at just one person.
Would you blame him for the header, the Matip header, which, you know, he heads it back to Dele Alli to score? Should Mignolet not have been shouting, you know, leave it or keep his ball? Or is that a Matip problem? Or?
Well, like I said, with goalkeepers having their position in relation with the defence, they were really high there.
Yeah. Mm.
Really high, and there's no need for them to be. There was no sort of... They didn't send the big guns up. So they didn't need to be so high and keep them away from the box. But if they're going to do that, then the goalkeeper has to be behind them in relation to that and start have a better starting position.
Mm. Let's talk about man management. It's something that we've all said that Klopp is very good at.
Yeah.
In his handling of Lovren there, Paul Hayward in the Telegraph came out with a great line this morning where he talked about not so much a substitution but an evacuation. When you're hooked after half an hour,
yeah,
that basically is a relationship ender, isn't it?
It can be. And I think Peter Schmeichel was saying yesterday that he felt that was a manager trying to absolve blame from himself by letting the world see it's this individual's fault, which is almost betraying a player. I have to say that you can also just look at it as a straightforward football decision and say the guy was dreadful. Mm-hmm. And were they going to concede more goals with him on the pitch? Probably. I mean, there was a logic to it as a football decision. Lovren's quite an emotional character. He's a bright lad, but quite a sensitive lad. So I think there will be a lot of work for Klopp to do there.
But he's also had injury issues as well, hasn't he? He said he's been playing with pain for quite a while.
Yes, and he's had various difficulties in his time. I mean, he before Klopp arrived, he was the scapegoat in the last year's weeks of Rodgers. You know, he was having a real sort of crisis then, and you know, Klopp sort of revived his Liverpool career, so he's kind of back in the position that he was a couple of years ago. I mean, I felt that a bit like we're seeing with Mignolet, where he's maybe overdoing it to try and assert himself. I thought Lovren's mistake when he missed the header, that was somebody just thinking, I got to do something and making a really daft decision. But I could see where it was coming. It was an emotional decision. It wasn't a clear-headed bit of defending. That's a job. He's got to take the emotion away from Lovren.
Mm. We mentioned Brendan Rodgers there in passing. Could you ever see him coming back to any of these jobs which might become available in the next few weeks?
No, but that's simply for the fact that I think he's just been loving life in Scotland so much. You know, the Celtic suits him, the ethos of the club, he's winning things, he's getting getting a lot of adulation. Mm. The only one thing is that the fact that they're unrivaled, particularly by Rangers at the moment, he's just lording it up there in Glasgow. Mm. And at the moment, he's playing Champions League football as well. He's still getting some credit in the last two seasons. Put some good performances in against Manchester City and Barcelona. So I don't see why you would.
And he's young, Brendan. I think he's a very early 40s, so he can maybe think, I'll take 3 or 4 years more in Scotland, get 10 in a row, get my statue outside Celtic Park, and he'll still only be mid-40s when he comes back to England.
I think the fact that if he does wait another couple of years, another couple of titles, maybe a few more good results in the Champions League, his stock will be even higher, so he can wait for a better job to come along than the ones available.
OK, well, this is real speculation, but how about in a couple of years he goes to Tottenham because Mauricio Pochettino has gone to Manchester United?
Well, I know exactly what you're saying, Mike. I mean, Pochettino, to me, has looked like a Manchester United manager for a few years now.
I think Mr. Mourinho's noticed that as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think it wouldn't have escaped Mourinho, that dinner that Fergie had with Pochettino that was, we're just getting to know each other. I mean, that was a little bit politically interesting. The thing about Pochettino is he's shaming pretty much every manager in the Premier League at the moment, with the exception of Guardiola. And he looks like he might be a perfect fit for Real Madrid. He's doing that. He needs to win something. But Manchester United, if they want him, may have to move a bit more quickly than waiting a couple of years.
Mm, yeah. Sometimes, as a neutral, you just like to watch a certain team. I don't know what you think, David, but I just love watching Tottenham as they're playing now, with that sort of natural vivacity.
Yeah, I think that the team I've watched most this year, probably watched them four times this season. Mm. And the thing about Wembley, I know people keep talking about, but gradually they are feeling more at home. And I think, it's quite telling that both the sides that they've scored more than two goals against, or more than one goal against even, has been Dortmund and Liverpool. Yeah. Two teams who really come at you. They've not respected the way that Tottenham play. They left a lot of space in behind, and they've suffered for it. Mm. But I think you're right. I mean, I think in the end it'll suit them, because what's tend to happen with teams who've dropped off them, the fullbacks are too high up the pitch. They're already in the space that they want to run into. But what's happening now, you see likes of Eriksen doing what Kevin De Bruyne does. Mm. He's practically going back into a right back position to pick up the ball and to create stuff. I think they're just slightly changing the way that they play. I think they still play their usual game away from home like they did at Goodison Park. And press people into space and deny them the time of the ball. But when it comes to Wembley, I think the way they're changing the way they play, it's going to suit them more.
And we hear managers moaning about injuries. Conte, Mourinho are at it. But he was playing with Serge Aurier in a completely unfamiliar role, out of position. He's playing with Harry Winks in central midfield. No other top manager would be playing with Harry Winks in central midfield at the moment, which is fantastic for Harry Winks in English football. But he's doing things that, as I say, put other managers to shame.
Mm. Do you think that City they've got one challenger, and that's not Man United, it's actually Tottenham?
It's a bit early to say United are busted flush, but I wouldn't put them any further ahead than Tottenham as challengers to City. And it already looks like, for someone to challenge City, City are going to have to blow up a little bit, because nobody's on their level, squad strength, the football they're playing. So they're going to have to mess it up somehow. I think even now you can see that.
What's most interesting about Manchester City's situation is it's not actually about them. Mm. The way I look at it, it's about how other teams cope with them and how they set up to try and stop them. I mean, at the start of last season, people kind of just... They got into the season and just stood off them a little bit and waited to see what happened. And then when, obviously, they saw a weakness in John Stones when he wasn't playing well, in Bravo, they went for the throat and they kind of pressed them high. Nobody's really actually done that to them yet. Nobody's tried to sort of nullify Kevin De Bruyne. Mm. But having said that, they've got so many options. It's almost like you've got half a dozen leaks in a dam and you're trying to fill it. once you fill it with one finger, another one sprouts somewhere else. Mm. So it'd be interesting to see what other managers do with them.
What about Ederson? He's 8 clean sheets, yep, which is only one less than Bravo's total for the entire season, last season. He's out Neuering Neuer as a sweeper keeper. He's actually, funnily enough, not got the credit perhaps that he deserved.
He's been well. I mean, it has to be said, he's been well protected as well. They've conceded very few chances Probably, I think it's the second least amount of shots in the league that they've conceded. But when they have come in, he's been there and he's dealt with them well. He's aggressive. When the ball's come to the box, high balls and crossing the box, he's very aggressive. And with through balls as well, we've seen that. And his distribution is almost flawless. And I'd be surprised if he doesn't go through the season without having 3, 4, maybe 5 assists. I mean, you look at Joe Hart the other week, you know, he got a lot of plaudits for lumping the ball up the pitch and it'd end up at somebody's feet and them scoring. Mm. But he's actually doing a lot with intent. And they've got the players who can do that. As soon as they get the ball, they're just like the Red Arrows, just sprinting forward.
Yeah, they're lovely to watch, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're just an absolute joy. I was sitting at the Napoli game last week, trying to draw little diagrams of you know, the positions that City were taking up on the pitch, because their shapes are unlike anything I've seen. I didn't watch Pep's Bayern Munich closely or Barcelona, so maybe it's old hat if you're a real Guardiola sort of scholar. But yeah, they're just, you know, as David talking about De Bruyne, the positions he takes to get the ball, the aggressiveness, the how far forward they get, how many men they get forward. It's absolutely fantastic. And they've always got someone in space to receive the ball. They've got so many players that can hurt you. And then the pace of that front line as well. That's, you know, Rio Ferdinand, that's the fastest front line in world football at the moment. When it's Jesus, Sané and Sterling, he's probably right. There's so many things.
It shows you how we've been brought up as footballers and football fans. It's, sometimes I get palpitations when I watch them passing the ball at the back. It's almost like in a small-sided game in training, they take all those positions where, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, you think, oh, I'm never giving a player a ball there. But they trust each other implicitly. And they're still going to give away chances. They give away a big chance against Napoli. Yep. And they got away with it. They're still going to do that. But the acceptance that they will do it is there by the manager, so it gives them confidence. Mm. But also they get more comfortable themselves with it, and there's no sort of trepidation. You know, every pass is firm, and they trust each other with it.
Napoli's the one team that troubled them. They did in the second half, and they kind of did it by out-citying City. They stayed with them physically. They pressed them as hard as City pressed the opposition. So Spurs are the only team that can do that in the Premier League if we're looking at head-to-heads.
Mm. If you look at Arsenal, They're being Arsenal at the moment, aren't they? You know, they disappoint, then suddenly they'll put up with a performance like they did at Everton, which disarms you again.
Yeah. The thing about Arsenal, they've still got a high number of really brilliant footballers. They've got some mediocrity there as well, but they've got so many good players.
If you're Wenger, do you sell Ozil to Man United in January to get some money in?
I mean, the argument against would be that you don't sell your rival, but are Manchester United Arsenal's rival at the moment, or are Arsenal trying to get back in the top four? I don't know why he didn't sell them in the summer. But if you are going to obviously cash in, you have to do it in January. If he's got someone to bring in, yes. But if it's just going to be to collect another 30 or 40 million to put in that gigantic sort of transfer piggy bank that he's got, then what's the point?
Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I mean, as long as it's not like somebody's not taking the mickey with you know, a really derisory offer. Mm. You know, they should take it. It's the type of club Arsenal are. You know, they're not wanting to waste money. And I think they'd welcome it. And you're right to say about are they really the rivals?
Mm. Yeah. But that if you look at that front three yesterday, first time they played together this season, Ozil, Lacazette, Sanchez, not bad. Mm.
I mean, I'm a big fan of Oliver Giroud, to be honest with you. Yeah. And I think he's not that he's underrated, but I think a lot of people give him undeserved criticism. But you're right, those three, if you think that they can keep those three fit and play them, they're going to cause teams a hell of a lot of problems. Mm. And showed that the other day.
What about Chelsea, Johnny? Because you've got Conte being backed into a corner by Mourinho.
Yeah.
You've got Raymond Verheyen, you know, the fitness coach, lambasting him and Klopp for basically over-fatiguing their teams through their training methods. Something's still not right there, is there?
No, and I mean, if you can have a bad 4-2 win, they had a bad 4-2 win on Saturday. Conte's demeanour's not right. You can see the holes in the system that wasn't there before. They look tired, and that goes back to Conte's Juventus. If you look at what happened to Juventus in the Champions League under Conte, they were really poor in Europe. They kept winning the domestic title, but they were really poor in Europe. So he hasn't ever been able to do, you know, both at the same time, succeed at both at the same time, the two games a week. So maybe that does speak of his his training methods. I mean, I don't know how Raymond Verheyen thinks he knows better than...
He knows everything.
He knows everything. I don't know. I'm not on the training ground, but nor is Raymond Verheyen. However, from the outside, they do look tired. They do look like they've got problems.
I think when it comes to fatigue, especially mental fatigue, I think it's not the end of the season. This isn't February, March, April. You know, players are still fresh. Injuries aren't taking the toll on people now. I think so. It's to say that it's simply down to fatigue. I don't think it shouldn't be a problem at the moment. Not for these players. When you think of the recoveries that they have now, the medical staff that they have, and they make sure that players are ready. Maybe it's only from Wednesday to Saturday. Maybe it's not 100%, but they're still in great shape and good enough to play on a Saturday.
Difficult club to manage, Chelsea, isn't it?
Oh yeah. I mean, they there's that statistic about how the last five of the last seven Premier League winning managers have got the sack the season after. I mean, I think Chelsea account for more than half of that, and they might add to that tally by the end of the season. I just don't think you ever quite feel that you're in charge, and that's what's nagged at Conte, because he, after last season, he expected to assert himself over the summer with transfers and this and that, and that's just not how Chelsea works. You are the hired help.
Mm. On some questions from the viewers and listeners, there's a United theme to the first couple of questions. You're going to be seeing United against Spurs on Saturday, which is one of those pivotal games, isn't it? Phil Parkinson, I assume it's not the Bolton manager, he said, should you think twice about signing a centre-back from a Portuguese club? He then makes a pun on the Mendicious, but he says there always seems to be a hype around them.
Yeah, I like this question. Portuguese clubs, it's not just the George Mendes thing, actually. You look at how Porto operate, how Benfica operate. They're brilliant sellers into the wider European market. They make that a business model. They're very good at marketing their players. And I think you should be careful about buying from Portuguese football. You look, Mangala came from Porto with great reputation. You know, obviously undeserved. Lindelof looks out of water at the moment. And this struck me a few years ago. I was in Portugal and I had a few hours to kill before getting a flight home. So I just went to a Portuguese league game and I must admit I was stunned. It was just a mid-ranking match and I was stunned at how small scale it was. It was sort of 6,000 or 7,000 people there. The standard was kind of League One-ish, but without the passion of the support. This isn't me saying that Portuguese football is rubbish. It's obviously not. But I think it's a bit like the Dutch league, where there are great sort of differences between the top teams and the rest. And the point I just want to make is that I think we sometimes ignore what's in our own championship or League One and think that it's always better out there in abroad. I mean, the fourth place team at the moment in Portugal is Maritimo, who get about 6,000 a week. And apart from when you're playing against Benfica and Sporting and Porto, you're going to play most of the season against these guys. So it's just a point that I think we overhype foreign signings a lot without being knowledgeable enough about where they've come from.
And do we overlook the fact, David, that there is, in some cases anyway, a difficult transitional period? So maybe you've got to judge someone on a second season. You know, Otamendi is almost looking like a decent defender at the moment, which is against all the odds when you consider how he played last season. Lindelof, will he get better given time and patience?
Yeah, I'm sure he will. But the transfer fees don't allow time. You know, the way people see it now, or the way everyone sees it, it's 30 million, 40 million. You expect a, you know, sort of buying off the rail, like, you know. You expect your suit to fit. Mm-hmm. And you expect them to hit the ground running and perform well. And he's right, but because of all the money that and the pound signs that the people see, that's all they see. They don't see the human aspect of that. They're being able to transition into a different way of life, you know, being away from your family for the first time, especially for young guys as well. Mm. So, you know, like somebody like Gabriel Jesus, for him to come in and perform the way he has, it's miraculous, really.
Mm-hmm. Ian Hamilton says, instead of criticising Man United, should they be praised? No. Last season, he points out, we had lost 3 games by now. Is that fair?
Well, where's he setting his bar? What's his expectations at Manchester United? I mean, they're doing well, better than their mediocre season last season. Well done. But they've spent so much money. This is Mourinho's second season. He's been able to build the squad. And to be fair, Mourinho, he's never tried to dampen expectations. He said from day one he's there to win the title. So it's absolutely fair to criticise him for a really unambitious performance at Liverpool and for losing to Huddersfield. If we're going to let Man United away with that, then, you know, I think we're being very generous.
Mm. Yeah, it shouldn't be judged against Van Gaal or Moyes' time at United. No. Everyone's going to be judged by Sir Alex Ferguson's time. Yeah.
Yeah, and when you look at those two performances that you refer to, Johnny, how much does Mourinho's attitude shape those two performances? I know he blamed his players in that for not showing requisite passion.
In the Champions League game and the
Huddersfield game.
Yeah, but sometimes it's hard to shake the attitude from, or the way you're going to play against Liverpool. It's hard to shake that because it's, for him, it was a success. And when he went back in the dressing room after the game, I still think he'll have impressed on the players that's this is the way I wanted to play. Didn't want to lose. If we won the game, brilliant. But this is what I went for. And over the course of the season, this is where I've plotted it. I plotted us to have a draw. So to change that sort of mindset and break out of that again, it just hasn't happened this week. And all right, against Huddersfield, you know, you give Huddersfield a lot of credit, but I think a Benfica side that had a young goalkeeper, and the fact that they have to rely on targeting a young goalkeeper making his debut in the Champions League, it speaks volumes.
Owen has come on saying, with all the three newly promoted sides starting well, were we wrong to write them off, or will they still go down?
It's a good question, because we've seen this before from promoted sides who maybe run out of steam in the second half of the season when everyone else has worked out their strengths and weaknesses. I didn't write off any of those sides, I have to say. You know, Brighton, really solid manager, been building for a number of years, been a good side for a number of years. The quality of Rafa Benitez speaks for itself. And, you know, David Wagner, as I said earlier, has done such a brilliant job, but you knew that was a club that had that small town first season of the Premier League passion about it, like a Burnley a couple of years ago, that they were going to be really difficult to beat at times. So I wouldn't have written any of them off. I'm not surprised by how they're doing.
You see a lot of Newcastle, David. What's your impression about the way that Rafa's working it there?
He's done brilliantly. I mean, when he first went in there, I've said this openly, that I expect him to have them in this position, as long as they backed him with in the transfer market, which they did in the start of last season, not so much this year. But if they backed him, then he'd have them up there in the top eight, almost top six, where they've been sitting now on Saturday. And I think that, especially with the group of players he's got, a lot of young players, they perform really well. And they've all sort of bought into it, you know. They've bought into to what the club is. They've bought into the way that Rafa goes about his work. And I think there's a lot of optimism up there at the moment. So, not just because of the takeover, but the fact that, you know, that Rafa, he's seen it the same way as he's seen Liverpool. You know, he's bought into the club as well.
We've got Paul Fry. As noticed, a decent player called Lionel Messi. Is he the greatest or not? And will we ever produce a player to match or eclipse him?
I'm afraid the second part of that's probably a no. Is he the greatest ever? The question always troubles me, just because we've got this thing in the modern world, we want to brand people the greatest straight away. I always look at Pele as a benchmark. You know, World Cup final at 17, brilliant player who won Brazil a World Cup as a teenager, 17-year-old, and does it again at the age of 30, scores 1,200 goals, redefines football, you know, gives football part of it, the global profile that it's got. I don't know how much more Pele could have done in his career, quite frankly, than that. So brilliant as Messi is and has been, I judge him at the end of his career against the body of work that Pele put together.
Isn't that fair, Dave?
Yeah, I think so, but there's also going to be this, I don't know, like an aura about the likes of Pelé and Maradona and Cruyff to a certain extent, how the way they influenced the game.
Yeah.
And with Messi, there's always been this rivalry with Ronaldo. They've been pushed against each other and they've pushed each other on to make each other better players. But when it comes to the end of his career, and people are talking about, is he the world's greatest? People are always going to point to the World Cup, and if he hasn't won the World Cup by the end of his career, then it's always going to be held against him.
Okay. I want the final discussion, quite a brief one, to be about the FA. Dirty job, but someone's got to do it. I'll set it out with a question from Martin Callardine. Greg Clark claimed that organisationally, the FA has gone from 3 out of 10 to 6 out of 10. Do we buy that? And what would it take to hit 10? Can these executives in charge do that?
I think Greg Clark's right. It probably has gone from 3 to 6. What troubles me is how smug Greg Clark seems to be about that, and how empowered the FA executive think they've done a few good things to an ancient, unwieldy organisation, but there's so much more to do. I think there's a lack of talent at executive level, to be honest. I think the big question that they were posed of to do with institutional racism and how you handle your employees, I think they failed on it really badly over the Anieluku affair. To get to 10 has to be a lot more change, a lot more diversity at the top, and probably a bit more talent.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But also, if you look at the situation that the FA are in, are they almost like reflecting the failures of the system? It's still, despite all the money that's gone into it, it's still an old boys' club.
Yeah, and I think, Greg Clark was saying that it's almost like he's doing the FA a favour. He's doing us all a favour.
That whole parliamentary inquiry was riddled with ignorance and arrogance. Yeah.
It's almost like it's an imposition. I'm like, you know, it's a bit of a bother. Oh, I don't really need this. You know, it's
going to kill my career.
It's, exactly.
Hopefully,
too much trouble. You want somebody who's at the forefront of the English game, who's got a passion for it, who loves the job and wants to improve the game, and you'd be able to see that his love of the game through that. He just didn't get that at all, and that was really worrying to me. Really worrying. Mm.
Well, how can the FA run football when they can't run themselves? They have no credibility under their current leadership. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.